Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to the LSE for this public lecture. My name is Sam Friedman. I'm Professor of Sociology at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Very pleased to be here welcoming our speaker to LSE this evening. Michelle Lamont is Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at Harvard, where she specializes in cultural and comparative sociology. I would say her research has been consistently groundbreaking in sociology, and as well as her deep empirical insights that her work has provided on topics like social judgment, worth and dignity, stigma and discrimination, and knowledge evaluation. She's also furnished sociology with a range of conceptual tools and frameworks that I think have been particularly influential, particularly the idea of symbolic boundaries and boundary work more generally. On a personal level, Michelle's work has had a big influence on me. I remember the eureka moment of finding her work during my PhD when I was trying to make sense of the way in which people in Britain use humour and comedy to draw not only cultural and aesthetic boundaries, but also moral ones. Michelle has written several influential books, including Money, Morals and Manners, The Dignity of Working Men, and most recently, Seeing Others. She also served as the president of the American Sociological Association in 2016-17, and is currently a Leverhulme visiting professor at the University of Manchester. Tonight, I believe Michelle will discuss her ongoing collaborative research on whether and how American and British young workers in the two Manchesters are searching for recognition through politics, how Indigenous people in Canada and Micronesia are seeking recognition through environmental justice and jobs, and the more general challenge of seeking recognition where it is impossible to obtain. If you'd like to join the debate on social media, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Events. The event is being recorded, hopefully will be made available as a podcast, subject to technical difficulties. As usual, there'll be a chance for you to put your questions to Michelle after the lecture. I believe Michelle will talk for about 45 to 50 minutes. So without further ado, I'll pass over to you, Michelle. Thank you. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for this kind introduction, Sam, and thank you also for inviting me to talk about my work here today. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for showing up, although there's beautiful sun outside. I know that it's luxury here in London, and it's just before your spring break, so I'm sure you all look forward to doing something else than hanging out in lecture halls. So, yes, I'm going to talk about this book, which actually came out in fall of 2023, and the last time I gave a talk in this very room was in 2017. I had been asked to, I was the British Journal of Sociology lecturer that year, and I presented a paper titled From Having to Being, which in fact was the inspiration for Seeing Others. So it's really nice for me to be able to come back. In that lecture, I went back to Mark Huse and other people that had been really important to me as I was a graduate student. So it was really a very nice moment for me, so it's great to be back here. So this book, Seeing Others, basically, it's been out for a year and a half, so I've been giving talks on it, but I've also moved forward in my research agenda, and I was a visiting professor for a month at the University of Manchester in May of 23 at the invitation of the British sociologist Andrew Miles, and we started talking about, you know, what's happening with young workers, 18 to 30, who don't have a college degree. It's a group that is far less talked about, or was certainly far less talked about then, than the college-educated Gen Zs, who are progressive, and tons has been written on those. So we decided to focus on this by studying Manchester, New Hampshire, and Manchester, UK. Actually, it's a little bit of a misnomer, because in fact, the empirical work in the UK is being done in Oldham. And actually now the project is the three Manchesters, because since we started this, there's someone who, a Finnish researcher from Finland, who works on Tampere, which is the Finnish Manchester. So now we have three Manchesters, so you'll hear a little bit about this later. But to go back to seeing others, so the inspiration for this book was what is now unfortunately known as the first Trump presidency. And as this moment in history, after he was elected, he started talking about the Muslim travel ban, and of course, you know, lots of declaration against LGBTQI people. So I was very attuned to the fact that he was engaging in stigmatization. Sociologists have the tools to talk about this, but the general population doesn't necessarily have this. And at the time, I had colleagues, Danielle Ziblatt and Steve Levitsky, who had just published their book, How Democracy Dies, which was very effective in explaining to the general audience, based on their scholarship on authoritarianism in Latin America and Europe, the process by which democracy is weakened. And just today, Steve Levitsky is in the media because he's attacking Harvard's president for basically kissing up to Trump. So his scholarship on authoritarianism continues to influence what he does. But here you have the cover of the book, two covers. The yellow one is the Penguin version that you can find in the UK. The white one is the American version. And I particularly like this one because the question the book asks is the one on the British cover, how to redefine worth in a divided world, with the goal of broadening the circle of those who feel they matter, those who feel they belong. And here you have the circle with groups of different size and colors that are further or closer from the circle. So the book really answers this question by proposing to the general reader, it's a trade book, so it draws on a lot of sociological knowledge that is not original. Some of the data is original, but some of the theory is not. To help the general reader understand what we can do, you know, you have Jonathan Haidt and others who talk about tribalism, the idea that we are wired to like people like us, and it's all about human nature. My point of departure is we don't know anything about human nature. It's a narrative. So in fact, there's a lot that we know about what makes group boundaries more or less permeable or flexible. And the book is basically about that, although this is sociological language that I don't use in the book because it's for general readers. And the second part, how it can heal a divided world, I really didn't want, but since the book was published by Simon & Schuster, they wanted to be able to list it under the self-help section, which really pained me, but basically I had to go along with it. So the context also, besides the Trump presidency in which I started imagining this book, is a concept of an explosion of social movements by different groups that felt that they were marginalized, they felt they were not given their due. So Black Lives Matter, Me Too, on the progressive liberal end of the political spectrum, but on the conservative end, the MAGA movement. So one of the goals was really to make the reader understand that these groups were seeking affirmation of their dignity, and this is a process that exists across the political spectrum, and we really need to understand it, in part because dignity matters for well-being as much as material resources. So this is really based on a multidimensional understanding of inequality that I'll return to in a few minutes. This is well known if you look at, you know, the research on well-being, the allostatic load, how you know, the impact of racism on stress and on subjective mental health, etc. So the question is again, who matters, who belongs, who is us? And in order to study this, I turned to two groups. The first groups are professional change agents, people whose job it is to create narratives that will influence how we think about who's in and who's out, who matters more or less. So it's based on interviews. And the other group are Gen Zs, young people born around the start of the century, who, when we interviewed them during the pandemic and just a little bit before the pandemic, were college students. So you have 80 people in the Midwest and the East Coast, half of them working class, half of them we define as privileged. And this project is really focused on the progressive, liberal end of the political spectrum. So we don't have the Andrew Tates and the Jordan Peterson. Other people are writing this book. I could not do everything in this book. But at the end of the talk, I will come back to what's happening in the U.S. today, where Trump is spending a lot of time attacking the very cultural sectors that I have studied in ways that are extremely aggressive. So the two t-shirts that you see here, on the white t-shirt is worn by someone named Zachary Drucker, who's a trans person who was a consultant on the show Transparent. And for the project, I interviewed Joyce Soloway, who is the creator of the show Transparent, and I also interviewed Drucker. When I asked them why this show existed, they said, our goal is to make trans people less abhorrent and more understandable, to depict them through their everyday life in a way that will allow the general viewer to relate to them. So Transparent is a show about someone who becomes, you know, trans woman, events middle age, she has to negotiate her new identity with her adult children. So this is something that many people can relate to as children or a parent. And it really humanizes. Joyce always said, my goal is to humanize this woman and to depict her in a more multidimensional way. So the words that I just used now are words that are used time and time again by the 185 people we interviewed for this project. Humanize, try to multidimensional, away from stereotype, make visible, make understandable. So a lot of it is about destigmatization, essentially. And the other t-shirt is something that became a poster that you could find on many people's lawns and in their windows all over the U.S. During the pandemic. And it's a proclamation of the importance of what in the book I call ordinary universalism, the idea of what we all share as human beings, essentially. So here you have No Human is Illegal, which was a response to Trump's attack against undocumented immigrants. Love is Love, a slogan that was at the same center of the same-sex marriage campaign, Black Lives Matter, Kindness is Everything. I'm not embracing Kindness is Everything for a reason I'll explain in a few minutes. But these two t-shirts really convey a lot of what seeing others is about. And of course, seeing others is an expression that has been embraced by Gen Zs and millennials in a context where the American dream really seems out of reach for them. And I will argue that one of the things that has happened over the last few years is them coming out with what became known as woke culture, but a lot of this is about formulating an alternative form of hope that will keep people going in a context where the American dream simply has lost its traction. And the idea is that people should live their best life now, and that should be accomplished in part by being able to live authentically. So that to be able to be public about who you want to be and ask people to treat you the way you think according to who you want to be and to be authentic. So that's the context in which I think things like, you know, non-binary restroom or the pronouns became something that the Gen Zs really embraced as a way to manifest how important it is for them to be recognized for who they want to be. So it's kind of an ideological shift away from an ideology of the American dream that is deeply assimilationist and oriented toward upward mobility at a time when these generations don't have access to this, and how they come up with an alternative form of hope that is grounded in inclusion and authenticity in a context of, you know, four decades of growing inequality. So it's really about the production of narratives of hope. And during this first Trump presidency, like many people, I was depressed. So I started reading the literature on hope. Where does it come from? And when you read it, there's a wonderful sociological literature on this. You learn that exposure to alternative narratives is absolutely crucial because it allows people, it gives people the tools they need to be able to articulate, to imagine an alternative future, which gives them hope. So I think a lot of what these professional change agents and the Gen Zs did at the time that we interviewed them was very much to create worldviews and diffuse narratives that would give people those tools. Now, you may ask, What do we care, given what's happening in the U.S. today? Well, you will see. I think I would suggest that these same views, these same narratives continue to be produced every day. And we have to remember that Trump didn't get the majority of votes. He got less votes than his opponents combined. And a lot of this cultural production is continuing, even if it's very much on the defensive right now. So we're going to have elections in 2 years from now, and we'll see what happens. But we cannot presume that what's happening in the White House summarizes what's happening in the U.S. as a whole. A lot of Americans are not behind Trump. So the case study, as I said, is based on these interviews with agents of change, 185 interviews with individual working across a number of organizational fields. This includes 75 interviews with comedians and Hollywood creatives, which resulted in a few separate papers. But you have also a lot of people in philanthropy, inclusive capitalism, a lot of other fields that you'll see in a second, and those AD Gen Zs that I mentioned already. I didn't do the interviews with Gen Zs because they're really pissed at boomers. So I had, they think we really screwed up with with climate change. So, but I had two graduate students who are really kind women and Gen Zs who did these interviews. As for the interviews with the Hollywood creative, this was the most popular assignment in my department for a few years because we really have a great, great list of people who were interviewed. So theoretically, some of the groundings of this project is based on a book and, you know, larger project, interdisciplinary project in which I was involved for 19 years. We were a team of social scientists from various disciplines. We met three times a year for 19 years, and we studied what we didn't like to call successful societies, but it's the name that was given to us by the organization that funded the work. And the idea was that, you know, what are the conditions under which societies can face the challenges that they meet, and how can we mobilize tools such as institution and cultural repertoires to help both social groups and societies and institutions meet those challenges. So it's a very much an alternative to the focus on individual grit that psychologists such as Angela Duckworth have been talking about and which has been widely covered in the media. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, and it's all about how individuals can pull themselves by their bootstrap. Instead, we're asking, how can we create societies that give people the tools they need to develop their capabilities to face challenges? And these tools are to be found in institutions and in cultural repertoires, in the cultural toolkits that are made available to us. So in this book, the cultural repertoires that I'm going to be focusing on are the ones that are created by these agents of change that I'm going to talk about. But this same thing is happening to institutions. So if we think about, for instance, same-sex marriage was not created to diffuse, you know, narratives about social inclusion and recognition to LGBTQI people, but to give them access to equal rights. And yet, because it contained messages about affirming their value and their access to one of the most sacred institutions of American society, it was the passage of these laws were correlated with a decline in attempted suicide. So it's a little bit like about the unintended consequence of a lot of institutional legal change and policy changes that provided destigmatization and affirmation. So there's a couple of, I'm not going to go long too much with the definition, but the book really hinges on this concept of recognition. There's a lot of philosophers who've written on this, Hegel, but also more recently Axel Honneth and Nancy Fraser, and it has to do with the social act by which the positive social work of an individual or group is affirmed or acknowledged by others. So what is key here is that it is intersubjective. It involves validation by others. It's, you know, if you think about Richard Jenkins' theory of social identity, our identity results from a combination of self-identification. What do I define myself as? But also group categorization, how other group define myself as. And the two of them together interact to create our social identity. So this is happening through positive affirmation, but also through stigmatization. And the two of them are unfolding as we lead our lives. So they're cultural processes that are constantly ongoing. When you have a job, you may be in an environment where you feel supported or not. As a member of an ethnic group, there's constant, you know, public exchanges about what your ethnic group or your religious group is about, around moral boundaries and other types of boundaries. So, and these identities get to be institutionalized in part through categorizations that the state uses or that are used in our organizations, etc. So, since this is an audience, an academic audience, I'll tell you a little bit about the meta-theoretical assumptions or theories that are behind this research. So it's really about understanding, you know, if you take the third column there, how to connect micro processes to macro processes, where the question mark is there. So in there, you can put institutions and cultural repertoires that I've already mentioned. And behind this is a kind of multidimensional understanding of how inequality is produced. So if you think about the classes we teach as sociologists, sociology of inequality, we go from the type one processes, which are the classics that we all teach about, Weber and Marx, domination, exploitation, opportunity, or the enclosure. These concepts are very much at the center of books such as Durable Inequality by Charles Stille or Mike Savage's book on inequality that was produced a few years ago. But there's much more than that. The type two processes became very popular during the 80s as Bourdieu's work became widely diffused internationally. So this is basically about cultural, symbolic, social, economic capital. And the third type is points to processes, cultural processes that are intersubjective and that unfold as we lead our daily life. And it's all again, you know, we had the beginning, domination, exploitation, etc. Here we have recognition, racialization, stigmatization, identification. They are all processes, but they have to do with intersubjective definition of identity. And they all feed into inequality. So one could say, okay, this is just a culturalist understanding of inequality, but no, it's not, because we also factor in, if you understand inequality as resulting from multi-causal processes, you would have in there also things like ecological effect that people who study neighborhood effects have focused on. You could have also distribution of resources, materialist distribution. So it's not a question of choosing between a materialist, a culturalist understanding of sociology. It's really toward moving toward a much more multidimensional understanding of how inequality is produced. And I have written several papers that are developing this perspective. The main one would be the first one, what is missing, cultural processes in the making of inequality. And I would say the paper I presented here in 2017, From Having to Being, is very much part of this as well. Okay, so now let's turn to the argument of the book itself. So, you know, many things have happened with the diffusion of neoliberalism over the last 40 years, from, you know, often with Thatcher and Reagan as the opening point for this, but the aspect that interests me most is the scripts of self that have become highly institutionalized during these 40 years, which basically tell us what kind of human beings we're supposed to be, what is desirable. And the model that has become extremely predominant is one that can be described as the neoliberal scripts of self, which tells us we're supposed to be highly successful, effective, agentic, engaged into privatization of self, that means of risk, which means you're not supposed to live off welfare, you're supposed to be self-reliant, you're supposed to, you know, try to be upwardly mobile, gain education, be able to consume, and be competitive. And meritocracy is very much part of this whole package, because it's presumed that whatever you achieve is achieved because of your hard work and your persistence. It's an ideology that presumes that we're all born in a, you know, we're playing in the same sandbox, but in fact we're not. My kids have two parents who have college degrees, sorry, not college degrees, PhDs. So of course they're born on an escalator, and sociologists of education have produced an enormous literature on this, but nevertheless, at the level of the media, meritocracy continues to be celebrated as something fair and just to which we should aspire. And it's something in which most people across all advanced industrial societies have become deeply invested. So here, an article by Jonathan Meisch, who used to be a postdoc here, that showed that across 25, I think, advanced industrial societies, the belief in meritocracy has grown exponentially since 1930. So in the US, for instance, something like 95% of Americans are belief that meritocracy works and is highly valued, and the UK is just slightly less. It's viewed as very important in all those societies but five, which includes Canada and France for some reason. And I'm Canadian, by the way. So the one of the problem with this neoliberal scripts of self is that with the American dream, it really feeds into very rigid symbolic boundaries which define people like us in this room as highly valuable, desirable, we can consume, we have access to, you know, most of what society offers because we have the college degree, the university degree that has more and more been operating as a basis for a caste system. And at the same time, the working class is consistently described as of lower status and unworthy. This is documented, for instance, in a book by Richard Butch, who did the content analysis of all entertainment television shows over 50 years, and shows that during all this period, the vast majority of the characters on these shows are upper middle class. You know, think of, or even upper class, White Lotus, The Wife of Beverly Hills, on and on and on. And the few times where you have working class characters who are present, they are idiots and buffoons. Like, think about Bart Simpson, just one example. So you really have this bifurcation in who is construed as worthy, and it has fed, you know, I think a growing, you know, mental health crisis among people in the lower half of the social ladder, as they view themselves as not recognized, as unworthy, as being put down. And this has been correlated. You know the argument by Anne Case and Angus Deaton, Death by Despair, you know, the opioid epidemic. I could go on and on about how the negative outcomes that have been associated with that. It's not great for the upper middle class either, because they have been so paralyzed by the idea of downward mobility, especially since 2008, that many of them have become extremely anxious about downward mobility and work. So the symptom of helicopter parenting and overwork has also had quite negative effect on a lot of upper middle class people in the mental health crisis that we face. So given this rather dire picture that I just described, we can ask ourselves, how do we move forward? So that's where cultural production comes in. So we can ask ourselves, what are the alternative cultural narrative? Who produces them? What are the messages? And the book focuses on three different messages that may have positive effect on our collective definition of who's worthy. One would be to move away from neoliberal conceptions of worth that are basically unidimensional, you know, money, consumption, education, versus a much wider repertoire of who's worthy that would include people who are caring, spiritual leaders, a lot of other ways to contribute to society. A second path would be to focus on ordinary universalism, which I argue specifically what Gen Zs are pushing for with their emphasis on inclusion and authenticity. And the third one is to understand how stigma has been reduced in the past and how it can be reduced again, precisely against those who pretend that, you know, tribalism is built into our human nature, hardwired, as they like to say. So in order to show how this works, we have these interviews that were conducted across a number of organizational sectors, And this is a kind of depiction of the public sphere, if you want, although these bubbles are, of course, much of very different size, and there's many more organizational fields that are involved in the production of the narratives that structure our environment. But some of the people we interviewed, this, I could show you several slides here, but I'm just going to show you this one, some of the Hollywood people we interview, which includes Michael Schur, who produced The Office in the U.S., The Good Life, Park and Recreation, The Queer Eye, you know, lots of interesting people. We were very lucky because it was the pandemic and everyone was available. You know, we used network to reach out to people, and then we sent them a letter saying, these people have accepted to participate. Do you want to accept to participate? It worked really well. You just count on, you know, FOMO, and it works really well. So if you look at the book, you will see the complete list. So just to give you a few highlights of what we found, there's a paper that's now forthcoming in Work and Occupation, which is specifically on the stand-up comics and Hollywood creative, and we developed a typology of the strategies they use, how they describe them. So we asked them, what do you do in your show? Why do you do it? And they would say many of them were very committed to promoting inclusion. So one of the strategy would be the first one, the Trojan horse, we called it, where they say, our goal is not to force people to eat their vegetables, we're there to make them laugh, but as we tell them our jokes, we also make fun of racist people or homophobic people. And that really came to, you know, I think of the 75 people we interviewed, only a handful of them opposed to what is called clapter, the idea that you use politics to get laughter. And these people were older white men who told jokes about sex, which they thought were not political jokes. Well, in fact, they were very much political jokes because they tended to be very, you know, misogynistic, etc. Anyway, so this is just a little flash to say this is how these narratives can be changed at the ground level, and they spread out and they diffuse. It's a little bit like the 1,000 points of light that Bush talked about, but in a very different kinds of way. So an example, if you want to Google this on YouTube, Question Bridge, you will see this video produced by an artist named Hank Willis Thomas, African-American artist, who interviewed, I think, 150 black men, asking them the simple question, what does it mean for you to be a black man in the US today? And he found that there was enormous diversity in their answers, except for one thing. They all talked about how they experience microaggression in their daily life. But what's interesting with this work of art, he's an art photographer, is that he collaborated with an organization, a philanthropic organization called the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. And this is like a network of more than 2,000 organizations across the U.S. And the local chapters used this video and diffused it in high schools and in community centers to create conversation around the stigma of black men. And their goal was precisely to challenge this stigma through collective conversation. So in the book, I talk about these collaborations between philanthropists and cultural producers, which I describe as recognition chains, which are central to creating narrative change. And this is very much at the center of the philanthropic sector for the last 15 years. The Ford Foundation, which is one of the largest foundations in the world, played a crucial role in leading this by when Darren Walker, who is the president, who is stepping down around now, came to this position in 2013, he said, my plan is to attack inequality, but I'm going to do this through four pillars. And one of them is what he called capturing hearts and minds, which is narrative change. So that was quite revolutionary at the time to say, we're going to use the money of this extremely powerful institution to create narrative change. Not only, you know, what had been done before, which was to give a lot of money to economists to do things like moving to opportunity, but really, you know, to stimulate cultural creation. So one of the things they did is they created an organization called Just Film, which financed films. Some of them became very influential. So if you think of Roma, for instance, which won an Oscar, and it depicts two indigenous women in Mexico City who are working for a middle-class family. And the whole film, you have the camera on the face of these two women, and the middle-class family is blurred in the background. And one of those two women is thinking about getting an abortion. So I interviewed Agent Poo, who was the director of the Alliance for Domestic Workers, who collaborated in the, you know, as a consultant on this film. And I was told, you know, the goal here is really to humanize, so again, the same word, humanize, dignify, make visible groups that have been historically very stigmatized. And this film went on to win an Oscar, and it was diffused very broadly on Netflix. So that, again, is an example of scaling up. It's not only about the production of narrative, it's about scaling up narratives to a point they become extremely visible, and they structure what people think is, what kind of society becomes valuable. So that's the first approach, you know, this multiplication and destigmatization of stigmatized groups and transform, you know, popularizing a much more diverse understanding of worthy self. We can also think about the process by which groups that have been historically stigmatized become less stigmatized. So I'll give the example of people with HIV/AIDS who were deeply stigmatized when the AIDS crisis started in 1980. I remember I was in Palo Alto then, 1983. People were really scared of people with HIV/AIDS, and the disease was construed as, you know, tied to moral boundaries, you know, gay men who were spending too much time having sex with random people in public bathroom. And then over time, this association was really interrupted, and the key actors there were knowledge workers, legal experts, medical experts, social scientists, journalists, who provided alternative frames saying, no, that's not how it works. Anyone can get AIDS. So these changes, you have the actors there, not only knowledge workers, but also social movement activists and public figures that drew on the cultural resources that were available in the environment to engage in destigmatizing action. So the point is, this is a process. It's accomplished. It can happen more. It didn't happen for people with obesity. So here we draw on Abigail Seghi's book, What's Wrong with Fat, where she explains how the medical experts objected to the idea of healthy at any weight. So this destigmatization did not happen for people living with obesity, but it did happen for. So the point is, it has happened, it can happen more. And then the intervention of Gen Zs was very much to kind of revisit what an ideal life would look like. So we have a couple of papers that look in depth at, there's a chapter in the book that's about them, but we also have this paper that looks in depth at how they understand the challenges of contemporary society and what kind of life they want. And what we find is they're young Americans, so they are genetic, they think it's important to take their life in their hand, but they also do something that people in my generation didn't do. They believe that they have something called mental health, and they really want to work toward the work-life balance, which is really crucial. So that is kind of a very revolutionary thing, but they also embrace the ordinary universalism that I talked about earlier. So, and that has been decried often as wokeism. So the book, at the end of the day, is really about the diffusion of these repertoires that trickle down at the level of everyday life. So this is another poster that you could find everywhere, also during the first Trump presidency, which is an affirmation of ordinary universalism, to say there's a lot of things that all human beings share, and these are things that we celebrate. Of course, it's not the end of the story, because, the point here beyond empathy is because it's not only a question of telling people, be nice, be empathic. It's really about structuring our environment in such a way that these repertoires are widely available and are really providing people the tools they need to lead them to think more in terms of weakening boundaries and being more inclusive. At the same time, we now know what's happening with since the beginning of the second Trump presidency, which is that he's been rapidly attacking those very cultural producers. So here I've highlighted what's happened only in the last 2 months, is attack against the Kennedy Center, Public Radio, Voice of America, the Smithsonian Museum. He's upset that all the museums in D.C. are not focusing enough on American greatness and are focusing too much on slavery and on, you know, all the injustices of the world. And just this week is really ramping up his attack on academic freedom in the name of fighting anti-Semitism. As we saw today, the president of my own university says, yeah, we really have a big problem with anti-Semitism. And he's not responding to Trump by saying, yes, you're using this in part to limit what's happening, what can be said in academia.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, so we could go on for half an hour, but I'm not going to talk about this more because that would be another talk altogether. But now, Jay, very quickly, because I just have maybe another 5 to 10 minutes, I'll tell you about what we're doing right now. So the idea, this book that I talked to you about is largely focused on the U.S., although there's lots of connection with what's happening elsewhere as well. I think a lot of the changes that I've documented since the last few decades hold in many European societies. DEI, of course, has been promoted far more in the U.S. than elsewhere, but it's also very present here as well. So, but now we want to, the question of this new book that I'm now starting to work on is really about paths to recognition. It's not about how recognition can be broadened, but it's about how various groups are using different paths to gain recognition. So we have different paired case studies where we're going to explore how this is happening across contexts. So the first one is about how groups are seeking recognition through politics, whether and how, and also how, so this is the case of the working class youth that feels very much that it has been marginalized in the context of politics, that it has been invisible, that it is not, doesn't have a voice. So how do they respond to this? So we presented our first paper at the Eastern Sociological Society 3 weeks ago. And I'll summarize briefly the result to you. A second project, so basically here, the interviews in Manchester, New Hampshire are completed, 45 interviews, and have been coded, although it's still ongoing. The process to gain human subject approval in the U.S. can be in the U.K. can be extremely slow. So, the interviews Oldham are still very much unfolding. So, unfortunately, it's too early to talk about findings there. And the same thing holds for Finland. Second part of the project is about First Nations, and this is a very important project to me because I grew up just next to Ottawa. And there's 2 hours north of where I grew up, First Nation people who live there. And I'll explain this to you in a second. And then, so the book will have these paired case studies, but will also focus on what I call the impossible cases. So how do people can claim recognition at LGBTQI in Senegal, Uganda, or even China, race in France, religion in China, immigrant workers in Hong Kong, etc. So the case of the two Manchesters is that both places are the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution in the respective countries. They are kind of similar because the two cities, if you look at Oldham or even Manchester, UK, and Manchester, New Hampshire, they were both at the center of the textile industry in both countries. They also had huge working class movement, extremely important strike. So one of the questions we ask is, What about place identity? What about memories of these working class fights? Do these still have a presence in how workers in the two places are thinking about their class identity and their politics? So basically, we ask ourselves, are they seeking recognition by staying away from politics, by embracing far-right politics, by embracing more progressive politics? So it's a little bit of a revisit of this enormous literature on working class identity in the US and the UK. Seymour Martin Lipset has written a very classical study, Why No Socialism in America? So we are planning to revisit some of these questions with the data that we are collecting now, in-depth interviews, 45 interviews in each country. So it's been very complicated because workers don't want to be studied anymore at all, especially young workers. Interviewing Gen Zs is very complicated because you make appointments with them and they don't show up and they don't tell you about it. You know, there's very much a feeling that data extraction is not cool and they don't feel any responsibility to contribute to social science knowledge. The people in the US that we interviewed experience a huge amount of insecurity. The minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. You don't buy two Starbucks coffee with that. And it's been that since 2015. So they are really suffering. Many of them have two jobs. And we did not, and it's a purple state, which means, you know, it can go red or blue, Republican or Democrat. And we did not expect this, but as we did the interviews between May and December during the presidential campaign, a large number of them progressively told us, yeah, we're not going to vote for Biden-Harris because we're really pissed at Democrats. They tell us that everything is fine, that the economy is fine, but no, we're very close to being evicted. You know, the experience of the inflation and the challenges to the economic challenges were just too big. But a large number of them are what would be called low information voters or non-voters. So we argue that, first, a lot of them are extremely allergic to politics. They feel that politics is drama. So they try to avoid it. Families are being split. It's just extremely difficult. So many of them try to stay away from it. But in the paper that we presented 3 weeks ago, we argued that there's various paths that they use. The two most popular paths would be distance from politics. I stay away from it because politicians don't care about people like me, and my best bet is simply to try to ignore it and lead my life without it. So it's a way of gaining recognition by maintaining distance and being agentic to some extent. And also what we call recognition through exclusion, which is to say I gain recognition by refusing to support other people who are freeloading off me. So the anti-sponge argument, that's the Trumpian who say we're not going to support Ukraine, we're not going to support Gaza, we're not going to support undocumented immigrants, we're just going to support people like me, hardworking Americans who are just carrying their weight and too bad for everyone else. And that's a third of our respondents are taking this perspective. Recognition through inclusion, which we define as basically those who are voting Democrats are very much, you know, altruistic, and often they connect their politics, their altruistic politics, to their own identity as people of color or as LGBTQI. And recognition by elevation, which we don't analyze in depth in the paper, is really, we're independent because we want to, we can make up our mind independently of parties. So they draw very strong boundaries toward people below. They are strongly identified toward people above, and they embrace the American dream. And they don't know what unions are. You ask them, what social class are you from? They don't know what's a social class. So we expect really strong contrasts with the Oldham respondents on all these dimensions, where also we expect that in Oldham, they will have much more of a sense of place identity that would be tied to their class identity. These people, you know, like the American working class moves around a lot. So they don't have any sense of what's happened in Manchester, New Hampshire before. And yeah, and no nostalgia. A lot of the literature on the growing popularity of the radical right is about the nostalgia of the working class. They don't have any nostalgia. They don't know what was happening 20 years ago. So it's very interesting. I think the data are kind of bringing a lot of correctives to, at least in the American context, assumptions that we have about what's happening in the American working class. And finally, I'll say two words about the Indigenous Project, which I'm really fascinated about. So Ottawa, the lower black circle, is where I grew up. I grew up on the Quebec side, just across the river. On one side of the river, everyone speaks English, or the majority speaks English. On the other side, the majority speaks French, which is where I grew up. And you, the two lowest circles there, Pequawkanagan and Kibarwak, which is the one further left, these are the two First Nations where I was able to gain access, which has been extremely difficult because there's been so much extraction. They are extremely distrustful. It's a process of negotiation. At least 2,000 emails were sent to make this work. So there's a nuclear waste disposal that is being built just across the river from Pequawkanagan there. And this wide section here is the Ottawa River watershed. In Algonquin language, it's called the Kishizibi River. And this is larger than Europe. You've never heard about this, but it's just one watershed. You can imagine the size of the territory. But this nuclear waste disposal site, you can imagine it could pollute the water for the whole region of the capital, Ottawa being the capital of Canada. So it really, you know, Pequawkanagan, which is located in proximity, they want this, they support this. This is the nation that supports this project because they want the jobs. But at the same time, they're indigenous people and this is their territory. And they very much connect their identity to the notion that this is where they come from, you know, this is their land. And many of them still live in the bush. Like one of them we interviewed has lived for 5 months under the tent in northern Canada. You can imagine what this is like. And they live of hunting and fishing, etc. And each family has a family line where they go hunting. So we wanted to do interviews in the fall and we couldn't because everyone was hunting. So it's really interesting to discover how they combine, you know, their very light involvement in the formal economy with a lot of subsistence living still. So it's this nuclear waste disposal is just next to Loiseau Rock, which is an Algonquin sacred site. And this will be compared to another indigenous group, which is where my research assistant, one of our graduate students at Harvard, comes from. She comes from the Mariana Island, which is 1,000 miles south of Japan. And it's next to the island of Guam. So you have Saipan and Tinian there. And Tinian is very important because this is where the planes that were carrying the Hiroshima bomb and the Nagasaki bomb took off. And Guam is where the military bases of the American government are located in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So if ever we have, you know, well, war with North Korea or China, this is where the attack will come from. But they're in the process. It's the status of these Northern Mariana Islands is that they are owned by the U.S., so the U.S. military can build military bases there, which they're in the process of doing. So these are boats that were in front of my hotel during the month I spent there, and these boats carry all the equipment needed to build a military base within 72 hours. In case of attack, and they are now in the process of creating these diverted military airfields that would assist Guam. So all this is destroying nature, but you have the same story as for the Algonquins, which is that they want the jobs, but they also want to defend the environment. So it's really a, you know, pull and push around these principles of, you know, recognition, you know, that are very much at odds with each other.
So we have hypotheses about how this works for the various groups. And what we know so far, 30 of the interviews have been conducted in the Northern Mariana Island. And for them, joining the military is very much a path to upward mobility, and they embrace consumption, and they want to be American citizen. So their commitment to defending the environment is pretty low in relation to the goal of, you know, social inclusion through consumption. Whereas in Canada, the interviews we've conducted so far, it's only 10, they very much talk about, you know, settler colonialism and all the things that the crown, the white settlers have done to them. So we are really interested in analyzing, we call it groupness, how each of the group thinks of itself as a group. And that's where we can compare the Algonquin and the Chamorros, is the name of the indigenous people in the Northern Mariana Island, and the U.S. workers in terms of how much do they define their identity in contrast to other groups, and what kind of repertoires they draw on to claim recognition. So you can see a little bit where the project is heading. This, of course, is way too sociological to present in the book for a general audience. So I think that will probably end up being in articles. But I'm thinking of writing the book as a travelogue, because I must tell you that the book has been quite an adventure so far. And I'm thinking it could be interesting for me to try another style of writing where I would talk about, you know, the process of discovering these various worlds and being exposed to how these various populations think about recognition. So I think I will stop here. I've already talked for too long, but I thank you for your attention, and I want to acknowledge the role of the other collaborators in this project, which includes Hilary Pilkington, who teaches at UMass, at University of Manchester here, and who's an expert on youth, European youth, and extremism. We're very, very lucky to have her, because she really has spent a lot of time studying this. And Andrew Miles, who's also trained as a historian and who's very interested in the question of place identity and class, and who's done a lot of collaboration with Mike Savage on the Great British Class Project, etc., as well as the various interviewers. So I think I'll stop here and we can exchange about the project.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.